The whole family pitches in to help on this project. Van carefully selects the material and develops the copy and the drawings himself. Members of the family assist on the stenographic work. Much of the material re-saved is so advanced and so cosmic in nature that it would only be of interest to advanced or open-minded scientists, astronomers, engineers, experimenters or metaphysicians. Only that deemed of more general interest is published. There is no fixed charge attached to a subscription to these proceedings. Everything at the Rock is on a voluntary love offering basis. We had the privilege of pitching in and helping the family with the mailing. We noted that one of the names on the mailing list of proceedings was Uncle Sam's FBIL. Then came an evening we had hoped for. We were invited to witness an OSC contact with beings living in outer space. This process at one time was pretty much open to anybody who wished to attend. For good and sufficient reasons, it is now by invitation. We went down a flight of stairs under the Rock, made a right angle turn down more stairs, 14 steps in all, and found ourselves in a large paved room far beneath the mighty Rock. The room contained chairs, davenports, tables and even a piano, also shelves filled with interesting books. Van took a seat in one corner and asked if I would sit next to him. The family gathered around, forming a circle. An assistant rigged up a tape recorder to take down any communication received. We are trying to report accurately what we observed. We feel we owe it to our readers. Let us here state that the entire proceedings were all completely new and strange to us. This reporting would not be complete if we did not mention one thing. I am not myself psychic at all, no more than a fence post. But I am rather sensitive to mild electric currents, to radiations and currents of energy, and I personally felt an amazing flow of energy in that room. It was something like a galvanic current through my body. I noticed that it manifested itself with particular strength before and during the contacts made by Van. We also wish to report for the sake of those who will be interested that some of the male members of the family circle are utter advanced students of the Far Eastern teachings of yoga, and one of them had been with Paramahansa Yogananda during his years in the United States. The family started by singing songs, popular songs, and then some well-known hymns. On one occasion they sang a certain song which Van had obtained directly from one of his space contacts. To us the music was very unusual, and the words were both simple and beautiful. It became a favorite song of one of his daughters. After a few moments Van succeeded in making the contact he desired. It was with a certain communications center in outer space. Now once again let us say that we are not experts in such matters, but we are somewhat familiar with the sight and sound rays recognized in certain philosophic and esoteric works as one possible basis of cosmic communication. As near as we could make out, both a sight ray and a sound ray were being focused on Van from outer space with pinpoint accuracy. Those familiar with Dr. Williamson's experience will realize that this is far from being impossible. Advanced space beings are masters of energy. Van talks to his spacer friends in a matter-of-fact way and helps them to focus these rays and to adjust their intensity so that he can endure the vibrations. If either the focus or the intensity of these rays or energy beams becomes maladjusted, Van suffers both pain and an excessive heating of some part of his body, often his feet. There is no lack of energy in the beams. On the contrary, they appear to possess almost frightening power, and delicate control is of the utmost importance if Van's body is not to be injured. Readjustments at times become necessary. Incidentally, Van can see the space beings with whom he talks and something of their surroundings, much as we observe scenes on a television screen. He can hear them, sometimes like a voice inside his head and sometimes telepathically as powerful thoughts. Van told us that at one time the energy beams got so out of adjustment that it felt as if his body was actually burning up. Since then the control center has made instant adjustments in the rays at his slightest request. He also told us that the sound communication is not limited to these more formal occasions beneath the Rock, but he has received the voice even when driving in a car, on the highway or in his room, either during the day or night. The voice is not weak. It is so loud that it overpowers everything else in his mind. We also wish to state that Van is also conscious of his human surroundings during the contacts. When the adjustments were complete, the communication center switched the contact to a space being in another locality who gave us a remarkable discourse on an important subject of current interest. It was characterized by great wisdom, love, and a dispassionate but helpful attitude toward some of our Earth problems. A few questions and answers were permissible, but not many. Van publishes some of this type of material in Proceedings, but he refrains from giving out very much of it. The reason for this is that our ways are not the ways of these advanced space beings, and their cosmic viewpoint treads too severely upon some of our most orthodox and cherished beliefs. From the nature of the remarkable information we received that night, we could easily understand why Van only releases a small and often watered-down version of it. However, we feel that for those with sufficient understanding, Van might be willing to tilt the lid of the cosmic viewpoint of these beings on almost any subject. But sincerity of purpose, and a certain measure of receptivity are indispensable requisites. It is interesting to note that these space beings have shown themselves capable of instantly detecting hidden and ulterior motives. The presence of certain human beings who are not sincere will in fact nullify the transmission. The history of the development of Van's peculiar abilities in contacting extraterrestrial intelligences is worthy of a scientific study by those scientifically and seriously interested in such matters. The development has gone through a definite series of steps or stages covering almost every phase of communication. More recently, it has gone through a new phase where Van is privileged in some instances to initiate a contact himself. This was not true in the earlier stages. Van is also turning to the concept that there exists throughout our solar system, under the control of the communications section of the Interplanetary Government, a continuous communications beam which he calls the Omnibeam. It is an energy beam somewhat in the thought frequency range which is on all of the time, something like a continuous TV or radio carrier wave. Those who are privileged and able to tune in on it mentally can accomplish extraterrestrial communication without the use of electronic or other equipment external to the human body. On another occasion, we discussed with Van the photograph of a flying saucer which had attracted our attention on the wall in the mess shack. We found that he had written an article on it and included his own explanatory drawing in the Proceedings of May, 1955. The photograph first appeared in The Coming of the Saucers by Kenneth Arnold and Ray Palmer, which stated that it was snapped at Hawthorne, California, on March 11, 1950, by Miss Bette Malz of Los Angeles. As we have stated, Van is one of the sorcerers who understands that there is both a physical and a supraphysical side to the saucers, and his commentary on this photograph bears this out. To quote briefly from Van's article in Proceedings, in her Miss Malz picture, she caught the ship between the stages of visibility and invisibility. The light motor, which converts primary invisible light lines of us into controllable magnetic energy, is clearly shown in operation. These ships nullify our gravity by remaining inside their own self-generated force fields. Consequently, the Earth's force field does not affect them. At this point in our saucer pilgrimage, both of us were fully aware of the fact that saucers were more than a physical or earthly phenomenon. While there is definitely a physical aspect to the phenomenon, of infinitely more importance, there is also a supraphysical aspect. Here is a sorcerer with a deep understanding of both aspects and of many truths regarding outer space itself which are not generally known. Here is a man with whom we could freely discuss these superphysical aspects and learn much of value regarding the cosmic nature of the great subject we have been studying. Van occasionally gives saucer lectures to special groups. His address before the Flying Saucer Convention at Giant Rock in 1954, which was attended by many leading sorcerers and several thousands of enthusiasts, was an outstanding and inspired denunciation of man's misuse of atomic energy and the attendant dangers to the Earth. In 1955, he lectured on flying saucers before the supervisory personnel of North American Aviation in California. This effort was enthusiastically received before a record attendance. We take leave. We left the rock with regret, promising ourselves that we would return. This we were able to do on a number of occasions. As we headed our car westward toward Los Angeles, Helen asked, "What are you thinking about?" "Well, I am thinking," I replied, "that we have just seen a great man, a cosmic-minded soul, George Van Tassel. He is an advanced apostle in the New Age if there ever was one." "Yes," she agreed. "I will always think of him as the sage of Giant Rock and will always be grateful for the privilege of knowing him. He reminds me of a veritable modern John the Baptist crying in the wilderness, 'Prepare ye for a new cosmic age.' But now, as in biblical times, the world pays little attention. I wonder why?" "Well," I replied, "it looks as though we always need pioneers, rugged souls like George Van Tassel with the courage to be out in front, to be ahead of the general level of human thought. At first no one seems to listen, but later, gradually perhaps they do. But what about the valuable information almost going to waste there at the rock?" she protested. "Yes, I feel the same way," I replied. "If the right people could take hold of such channels of cosmic information, learn to appreciate their value, and help develop them, finance them, protect them, there seems to be no limit to the practical applications that could be brought forth for the benefit of mankind. What an opportunity this would be for retired scientists or sincere cosmic-minded researchers, people of goodwill and with an unselfish spirit of service to mankind. But now Van is only one man and he can only do so much, but a group could accomplish much more. What impresses me is the willingness of the great cosmic beings he contacts in higher spheres of life to help us who are still on the Earth plane. Just what type of space beings do you think Van is contacting?" asked Helen. "From the quality of the information coming through," I answered, "which is probably as good a way as any to judge, they seem to be on a very high level. As near as I can judge, they must be closely connected with the cosmic group which governs this solar system, particularly the communications group. It appears that mankind and the Earth have reached such a critical state that we have run into the big boys, the planetary guardians. Why do you think the space beings are establishing these Earth contacts at this time?" inquired Helen. "They certainly would not do this without some good reason," I replied. "There are not too many of these cosmic telephones in the world, but we have seen that they do exist and that they are available to certain people who learn about them and cooperate with them. Maybe if a sudden worldwide emergency should arise, they will be of untold value to those who are aware of them. Let us hope that we ourselves never lose touch with this space contact. Sometime we might need it." With these sobering thoughts, we silently sped westward to our meeting with another pioneer sorcerer, Daniel Fry. An application of universal energy. On the way we passed through Riverside, California, and decided to make a brief detour to visit the orange grove which George Van Tassel had told us was protected from frost by an application of certain principles of universal energy. We understood that spaceships draw their energy from space itself, from the sea of energy in which all life's manifestations take place. We often wondered why man on Earth did not make more use of this type of ever-present energy. We were, therefore, very curious to find out about this particular example firsthand. It was first brought forth by Mr. John DeLand, who passed on a few years ago, and it is known as the DeLand Magnetic Control. We found Mrs. DeLand at home, and she directed us to the installation at a 15-acre orange grove owned by Mrs. Eva B. Hibbs, also of Riverside. The owner kindly took us around the installation, part of which dates back to 1950. It consists primarily of a 32-foot mast in the center of each acre of orange trees, down which run 7 number 10 bare copper wires parallel to the mast and spaced a few inches therefrom by means of plywood discs used as insulators and spacers. Each mast is made of ordinary galvanized iron pipe of 2-inch size at the base, which is set in concrete, reduced to 1.5-inch and finally 1-inch size at the top. At the foot of the mast the wires run underground and then branch out in 7 different directions about 18 inches below the surface toward the confines of the acre plot. An interesting feature of the installation is that at the end of its underground run, each wire is first coiled around an Alnico permanent magnet about 1 inch in diameter by 5 inches long and then protrudes upwards slightly above the soil. A short length of each wire is bent back toward the head of the mast. One wire is oriented to magnetic north, while the others are at equal seventh divisions of the compass. No man-made energy or power is employed. The installation has done a remarkable job, not in reducing the atmospheric temperature in the grove, but in preventing the fruit from freezing, despite some freezing temperatures as low as 20 degrees Fahrenheit and some unofficial temperatures of 17 degrees. Fruit that falls to the ground will freeze, but that attached to the trees will not freeze. Besides the effective frost control, the owner reports a noteworthy increase in both the yield and the quality of the fruit produced. One reason we were particularly interested in this installation is that it lends strength to a growing conviction within us that practical usage can actually be made of technical information received by OSC methods, as Van has suggested. It seems that Mr. Deland had initially received the basic concepts for this work through a form of OSC outer-space communication. What an intriguing possibility! Think of the acceleration in human progress which could result. Chapter 14. We visit Daniel Fry. On April 26, 1955, we headed the car toward the little California town of Puente, some 25 miles east of Los Angeles, to see Daniel Fry. Most saucer enthusiasts know him as the man who rode a flying saucer, but his saucer experiences go way beyond this. We had read and reread his notable book The White Sands Incident many times and likewise his later pamphlet Allen's Message to Men of Earth. We had difficulty finding his residence, but we finally located it by his name on the mailbox. Nobody was home, so after waiting a while we decided to return the next evening. We were glad we did so, because this time we found him at home with all his family except the son. We met his wife and two nice daughters, one of whom was of high school age, while the other was younger. We had a wonderful visit. Mrs. Fry was interested in a little bookstore which she and a friend were starting in a nearby town. We went there with her the next day. They were specializing in saucer books and allied New Age publications. At that time Daniel Fry was still working as an instrumentation technician on rockets and similar projects, which is his specialty. More lately, however, we have heard that he is writing another book and hopes to do experimental work on his own. We talked about our Mexican saucer race activities, his own remarkable experiences and his estimate of the present world situation. For the sake of those who are not familiar with his experiences, it may be well to outline them briefly. Daniel Fry, up to the time of our visit, had had four distinct experiences with flying saucers and the extraterrestrial beings who operate them. The first experience, his trip on a saucer, was on a physical plane. The second and third were in the nature of outer space communication, OSC, and the fourth was a combination of a physical experience and an OSC experience. The first occurred on July 4, 1950, and included his 4,000-mile ride in a saucer and discovered in the White Sands incident. The second happened about 2 years later, and the information obtained then has not yet been made public, but he is now considering releasing it. The third experience occurred on April 28, 1954, and is set forth in Allen's Message. The fourth occurred on September 18, 1954, and we will mention it later. Both of the books came out in 1954, and as researchers we have found it necessary to avoid confusing the dates of publication with the dates of his experiences. There was a long delay in publicizing the first experience. Besides his writings, Daniel Fry lectures occasionally on his experiences to special groups, as do other sorcerers. He delivered a lecture in Detroit, Michigan in 1955, sponsored by the Detroit Flying Saucer Club. It was a wonderful lecture and presented a wealth of saucer information relating to both the technical aspects and the insistent messages of the space beings. Daniel Fry's background should make his experiences of especial interest to those who are technically minded. While he was only able to complete his high school course of education, he possesses a self-education in chemistry, physics and electronics which many a college graduate could well envy. Personally, he appeals to us as a salt-off-th type of man. He is a trained technical observer and a very precise thinker. He has a good reputation for reliability and integrity and is well respected. At the time of his first experience on July 4, 1950, he was stationed at the White Sands Proving Grounds, New Mexico, USA, near the town of Las Cruces. The Ogan Mountains are in the vicinity. He was then serving as an employee of the Aerojet General Corporation and was engaged in instrumentation work in connection with the testing of some extremely large rocket motors. It was near evening, and most of the personnel had gone to town to celebrate Independence Day. Only a few remained at the post. Through a chain of circumstances, he was one of those remaining on the base, and toward evening he walked out onto a lonely portion of the grounds. A flying saucer appeared silently out of the darkened sky, decelerated and landed fairly near him. It was approximately 30 feet in diameter and 16 feet high. The shape was that of a flattened sphere, flattened at the top and the bottom. The material was some sort of metal, highly polished on the exterior, presenting a silvery color. There were no portholes at all, and at first he could see no entrance. He learned a few minutes later that no one was aboard it, but it was under remote control from a control ship or mothership located some 900 miles above the Earth. Its purpose was interesting. It was being used to gather some of our air and transport it to the control ship, where it was mixed with the space of visitors' own air in an effort to acclimate them to breathing and living in our atmosphere, which is different from their own. Daniel Fry's introduction to the visitors was quite dramatic. After an intense inner struggle as to whether to run and call for help or stay and see what would happen, his technical curiosity finally got the better of him and impelled him to touch the strange object, first gingerly with one finger and then with the palm of his hand. He was noting the peculiar slippery surface of the metal and the fact that it was a little warmer than the air, when a loud voice from the interior suddenly warned him in English that it was dangerous to touch. He jumped back, tripped and fell full length. A chuckle from within the saucer completed his utter humiliation, and this was his unique introduction to an extraterrestrial being, a spaceman with whom he was destined to have many experiences. By mutual agreement, he calls this space friend by the name of Alan. Events moved quickly, and after recovering himself, he was offered a short flight in this small ship, which their owners called a small cargo carrier. A door which fitted so perfectly that he had not noticed it before was opened, and suppressing his fears, he stepped inside the saucer into a small cabin. The voice he had been hearing was coming through some type of loudspeaker controlled by the mothership. The interior was lighted by a small projector, and he seated himself in one of the several available seats. After a short discussion, it was agreed they would take him to see the lights of New York City, some 2,000 miles away. And they assured him it would not take very long. He asked how they expected him to see anything, as the ship had no windows. The operator settled the question by directing a beam of bluish light from the projector toward the door. The door was of thinner material than the walls of the craft, and by this time the door had been closed. Under the action of the light beam, however, the door became transparent and thus served as an excellent window. The ship rose some 30 miles in elevation for most of the trip, but it descended to about 20 miles over New York for a better view. After circling the city, the ship headed westward for the return trip to White Sands. The entire flight, covering approximately 4,000 miles, was accomplished in about 30 minutes' time. This was an average speed of approximately 8,000 miles per hour, better than twice that of Earth-made rockets then in use. All during the trip, Daniel Fry persistently asked questions. He told us there were literally hundreds of questions beating at the fringe of his consciousness, and he asked as many as he could, one after the other. Each question brought forth a prompt, simple and understandable answer. As he put it was as if one had placed in my hand an encyclopedia and said, "Here is all the knowledge in the universe, you have 30 minutes. Most of the questions were technical. This was no interplanetary saucer but a small remote-controlled utility affair, working on magnetic principles with a limited range, and entirely dependent upon the control ship for recharging its accumulator with energy. Despite some incredible accelerations during takeoff, Daniel Fry experienced no discomfort in the ship from this cause. The explanation given was that the application of energy was of such a nature that every atom of the ship and its contents, including his own body, was acted upon simultaneously, so that everything moved together and thus no pressures were felt from inertia forces. The accuracy and effectiveness of the remote control were noteworthy. The operators could control all of the forces acting upon the ship and maneuver it precisely, even controlling its turning on a vertical axis so that they could point the door toward objects to be viewed. The craft was landed with great accuracy only a few feet from the original takeoff point. However, not all of the questions were technical. Some were of a more general interest. Daniel Fry learned to his surprise that this contact was no accident but was planned by the space of visitors. In fact, they even took a hand in some of the circumstances which made it possible, and they deliberately ransacked his mind prior to the contact to make sure of certain things. Their speaking English with considerable idiom was also no accident, because this took 2 years of preparation on their part. The control ship was not from any particular planet but was from outer space itself. In our own private research, we have applied our own methods of coordination and comparison to our study of this contact. We have even studied the history of various efforts which were made to ridicule it. We only wish that in our reporting we could somehow convey to our readers some of the qualities of Daniel Fry himself, especially his humility and sincerity. While our own ideas may not be too important to others, for the sake of the few who may wish to know, our own study indicated to us that this was a physical contact, and we feel that the information gained will in time emerge as an historic landmark in man's effort to understand and master outer space. Daniel Fry's second and third experiences took place at a location far distant from the first, at a little ranch which he had acquired in an isolated and wooded section in the state of Oregon not far from Grants Pass. In contrast to the first, these were not what would ordinarily be termed physical contacts. They were OSC contacts, that is outer space communication contacts, and took the form of a voice inside his head. The voice was that of his space friend Alan, so clear and distinct that Daniel Fry was able to carry on a conversation in this manner. We learned that this type of communication holds no mystery for him. He realizes that space beings are masters of energy and possess the ability to modulate currents of energy on the auditory nerves of a human being, which will then appear to that person as sound or speech. On the occasion of the second contact, Alan in this manner was able to give him considerable information which, however, he has not yet published. As we have previously stated, he is now working on this and may release it in the near future. The third contact on April 28, 1954, was of a similar nature, but it was particularly interesting because it was the only case in which he tried to initiate a contact himself. After a 3-day effort, he finally succeeded, only to be very severely rebuked by Alan for his failure to share and make public his other experiences. It was only after this severe prodding by his space friend that he overcame his fears and distrust of his own abilities and was stimulated to put his experiences in writing. It was this contact also which gave him Alan's message to men of Earth. This message is a remarkable exposition of what is wrong with our world and the chief remedy that is needed. The major Earth difficulty, as set forth in Alan's message, is that our physical science has developed so much faster than our social science and our religious science that we are dangerously out of balance. By developing mutual understanding and helpfulness between peoples everywhere, we must strengthen our social and religious foundations sufficiently and develop them faster in order to support our scientific progress, or our entire civilization will soon collapse. It is a stirring message couched in non-critical terms of helpfulness, wisdom and love. Many people want physical flying saucers without any strings attached. We doubt if this is possible. The space people come to Earth always with a purpose and a serious message. Why try to ignore this fact? While we were talking to Daniel Fry in his home, we asked him if this third event had ended his experiences with the space people.